Hello everybody, thank you for coming. So today we are very happy to have Nicolas Bourdin from the University of Paris-Panthéon-Sorbonne. Nicolas was trained in Canada in archaeology. He did his PhD at the University of Southampton here in the UK. And he has a very extensive fieldwork experience around the world in archaeology. So he did research in Canada, Japan, Australia, UK, and recently, for a few weeks, in France. And so today he's based at the University of Paris-Panthéon-Sorbonne, and he conducts research on the political economy of modern archaeology. But previously, Nicolas has worked in Greece on many excavations since 2001, every year, I think, and mostly did excavation in prehistory. So he's going to talk about the movement of population during prehistory and the last millennia. We are not used to focus on this period, so we are very excited to hear you, Nicolas. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Marie-Laurence, and thank you to the Department of International Development to have me here today. I'm a bit nervous as well because I never spoke to people who are not archaeologists, so it's a bit surprising. Even though I was rereading my preparation and I realized the vocabulary is probably different from the one you use, even for talking both about migration. So I hope you will understand what I'm talking about, and if not, please interrupt me. And I'll try to alternate between quite a formal paper to a non-formal presentation so to make it more alive. All right. So for archaeologists, migrations have been one of the most important preoccupations of anthropologists and archaeologists in the last two centuries, but often for the wrong reasons. Migration were at the core of attempts of defining identity, in direct relation with the illusory attempt to define an origin, linking our modern nations to a distant and glorious past. The idea with migration studies of the past was too often to give matter to political projects to unite or to divide and exclude populations. Fortunately, archaeology and anthropology took great distances from political instrumentalization and colonial behaviors, and we can now ask what migration really is. Well, I say we took quite a distance from political instrumentalization, but it's not totally true. There is many places in the world at the moment which is using archaeology as a political tool for different reasons. So, unfortunately, archaeology and anthropology are not necessarily neutral, even nowadays. So today's talks aim to focus both on the importance and the normalcy of migration in human history and in the last 100,000 years. I would like to present you some examples of past migrations that we know of, thanks to the various research conducted in anthropology and archaeology, and thanks to some historical sources. Concerning migration, it is crucial to remember that an ability and a propensity to migrate over large distances have always been defining features of our human species, Homo sapiens sapiens, right across the globe. So the focus of my talk is on prehistoric populations, and on some historical cases as well, but prior to the massive global movement of the past centuries. So what migration means exactly for archaeologists and anthropologists? I guess it's probably close to the definition you're using yourself, I guess. So migration, for the purpose of the prehistoric and early historical records of the human affairs, can be simply defined as the movement of all or part of a population to inhabit a new territory separate from that in which it was previously based. And that's a definition from Bellwood in a book written in 2014. And as you can see, we can, and we'll see that in more details after, define migration in different ways, like in waves. We'll see how we use the concept of leapfrogging or cyclical migration, and you're probably familiar to this type of migrations. I was planning to give you different definition of variation of migration, for example, invasion or colonization, but I think it's not necessary. So we're going to go directly to something I think it is important to clarify, is the term colonization. For us, for historians, colonizations means migration into territories previously devoid of human inhabitants. And I just want to clarify this because we use the term colonization for different purposes, and it means often that, I mean, even the definition we use means terra nullius, and that means there is no population inhabiting the land you're colonizing, but unfortunately the concept is used even when we move to America, Australia, and other places where actually humans were already living. And on the map, you can see to the right here, you can see the movement and the migration of Homo sapiens sapiens starting between 200,000 and 100,000 years ago, getting through the Sinai, getting into Asia first and then Europe. And we call this colonization, but again, actually it's an invasion of lands occupied by the descendant of Homo erectus. And the colonization only starts in, actually, when we pass Asia and we start getting in what is now today Russia, and as well Australia, Austronesia, and then later America. Interesting thing is, it's extremely difficult to represent through like this amount of time how land looked like. I mean, Earth didn't look like that 100,000 years ago, of course. So you have to connect Australia to Indonesia at the time. It was one block, and it's more or less connected to the continent, actually, because level of the sea was much lower. So it's difficult to represent, difficult to imagine, but the space evolved and changed as well during all this long period. So how do we study the migrations of the past? We use normally three major tools: is archaeology, comparative linguistics, which probably you're familiar with, biological anthropology, which is extremely fashionable in North America, with the study of skeletons and genes, and as well we use analogies with contemporaneous ethnographies and some historical sources. And this is crucial, for example, in North America, where we have testimonies of the encounters of French or English settlers with Native Americans, and we have texts actually describing the life of Native Americans during the period of contact. So we have direct testimonies, written testimonies, of a different way of life that nowadays disappeared. So we use also those type of sources. So archaeology, that's the first topic I want to talk about. And so archaeology, basically, it's more or less old rubbish, clearly. But rubbish that has a tale to tell. So if it did not, there would be no archaeologist, although I must insist that the archaeological record consists of far more than just rubbish. Artifacts, offerings to the dead, art and architecture, ways of acquiring and processing food, technology in stone and metal, and human environment relations all play major roles in interpreting the past. So when taken together, they allow us to read how ancient lifestyles as expressed in material culture migrated hand in hand with human population across continents and oceans. So as for example, Cardium pottery, which I display here on the screen, is a combined marker of migration from east to west of southern Europe and of diffusion between the beginning of the 6th millennium and the 5th millennium. So just to give you an example, how we trace movement of population and diffusion as well, which is actually difficult sometimes to separate, to differentiate. But Cardium is actually the name of the shell that you see here in the middle of the screen, and which is used to make the decoration on the pottery that you see here. So for us, it's a major marker that allows us to follow populations or follow the influence of the population of other local populations. And that, for example, is a fantastic marker for us to follow migrations of Indo-European population, farmers' population, from Middle East towards Western Europe. And we'll see that in more details after. Another tool we use extensively is comparative linguistics. And that's a typical example of the hot debate that was going on for the last 50 years, is to define the origin of Indo-European, so all the source of what all the languages we use nowadays in Europe, in most of Europe. And you can see to the right all those languages that we use that are based related to Indo-European languages. And there is a fight between archaeologists and linguists to define where is the source, where is the origin, and when it started. And the diagram you see to the right, that's the archaeologist biological anthropologist hypothesis, so starting 8,000 years ago. But in linguistics, they want to push it much further, around 5,500 years ago. So there is still a conflict going on, but it seems that genetics is clarifying the situation now. But the hypothesis of the linguists were based on one, especially one word, not only, but just to make it simple. And for example, Maria Gimbutas, which was a Lithuanian-American archaeologist, and we relied heavily on linguistics, argued that the origin of the Proto-Indo-European language is to be found in actual east of Ukraine, so as you saw on a previous map, on the green area, and southwest of Russia, based on the hypothesis that all Indo-European languages possess the term wheel, which was invented, the wheel, not the word, the wheel was invented between 4,500 and 3,500 BC. And based on that assumption, Gimbutas suggested that the spread of Indo-European could not have happened before that date and needs to be found in a horse-stepped related environment, and this is called the Kurgan hypothesis. This is all very interesting, but unfortunately, it's highly hypothetical, and the problem is the meaning of the words probably slept, if I remember well the term in English, which means it is tricky sometimes to connect the word wheel to the word winnow. For example, she connects her herky, rote, queklo, arguing that it means wheel, but through the years, through 100 years, the meanings have moved a lot. So it's tricky to connect them to the term wheel and to assume that we're talking about something using wheel. So basically, the debate is more or less closed nowadays, because genetics demonstrate actually that archaeologists were right. And the source, is the origin of Indo-European languages is probably Southern, which is Anatolia today, and the spread started much earlier. And we'll see, we'll illustrate the change later. So it was a nice attempt, but it seems a failure. Another tool we use extensively, and mostly in North America, because because of our history in Europe, there is always a little bit of a distance with biological anthropology, was used by the Nazi regime in Germany to demonstrate things that were related to their political aim and goals. So in Europe, there was always a bit of a distance, but it's used more extensively in different areas of the world. In Japan as well, and here I use an example of some research that's been conducted on different skulls and the skeletons found in a different excavation in Japan. And basically, Japan has two genetic pools. One genetic pool that is called Jomon type, which actually means prehistoric type, which is the first wave of migration of population coming from south coastal of China, actual south coast of China. So more 1,000 population that populated the entire islands of what is now Japan. With a stabilization of those populations for more or less 14,000 years, and a second wave coming from what is now Manchuria or northern China and Korea around 300 BC, with an arrival of what is now located around Fukuoka here, and a spread of those population called Yayoi type DNA population. We came with a farming kit based on rice production, while the Jomon had a hunter-gatherer way of life. So we have a completely genetic pool arriving and a different way of life based on a different technology that the previous population didn't know. So as soon as the Yayoi enter what is now Japan, actually Kyushu, they will penetrate very fast following the internal sea of Japan until what is now Tokyo. And around this axe, the Yayoi type DNA will develop and stay and develop. The only thing is, we thought for a long time that the Yayoi spread all around the islands of Japan, but actually they stay in this axe, and the rest was diffusion. So that means the hunter-gatherers were actually still Jomon, were Yayoiized interculturally, but not genetically necessarily. But 2,000 years later, in Japan, they sometimes like to differentiate still today and say, okay, we still recognize people that are more Jomon and more Yayoi, but that's a bit exaggerated because 2,000 years of mixing doesn't justify to be able to separate Jomon and Yayoi. And it's even a bit dangerous because you never know what you can do with that. But that's another way to study migration for us. So migrations. So migration has always been essential for humankind, as we saw, and for a long time. And according to Anthony Marcella and Erin Ring, it is inherent in human nature, an instinctual and inborn disposition and inclination to wander in search of new opportunities and new horizons. In a sense, humans are born migrants. Our evolution is fundamentally linked to the act of migration, to moving from one place to another and adapting to that environment. For every migration, there will be a hierarchy of underlying environmental and cultural causes, and these causes need to be identified and understood by prehistoria. So why did we migrate? Why did we migrate in the past? As far as we know, the main reason behind the words major migrations, was, as demonstrated by archaeological and environmental data, human and demographic. In a sense that growing human populations require new resources, and especially territories. This is particularly true after the Paleolithic period. While humanity represented a more or less balanced total population of 150,000 inhabitants and on Earth, and about 30,000 humans for Europe. So that's very important numbers. It's difficult to actually imagine that, but we were only 12,000 years ago, we were only 150,000 on Earth. That's it. And so we switched from this very low demographic patterns to a pattern of constant growth population, supported by the end of the glaciation period, 12,000 years ago, called Mesolithic, and followed by the diverse Neolithic revolutions around the globe. So this is, I think, crucial for prehistorian to understand that we have a very stable environment for a long time until 12,000 years ago, and the end of glaciation, so a major climatic change, actually generate a massive demographic change as well. And that's the beginning of the massive change for humanity and the beginning of massive migration as well. So what were the conditions facilitating migrations in the past? So the classic model is called push-pull, and we don't really like it. I think it's the same for you, because it is far too determinist, it is far too Eurocentric, and far too simplistic. But because we deal with dead people and not real humans, we have no choice to create models and to organize ourselves with what we have. So we have no choice to use those tools. But we try to compensate with what we know from ethnographies, and we try always to add a cultural addition to it. But unfortunately, we're reduced to very material things and statistics. So we deal with numbers a lot. So for us, the push is defined by a negative stress in the zone of origin, and most of the time demographic stress, but it can also be combined with environmental and climatic stress, as for example. The pull in archaeology is an incentive in a favorable area, combined with a low or acceptable cost of transport between two zones. So as I said, we don't only consider the push and pull model, but we know that population might migrate as well because they are exploited, they're oppressed, or they're just simply pushed away by a dominant group. We know that as well that cultural values, beliefs and myth plays a very important role in migrations. And a good example is probably Austronasian migrations, who started 5,000 years ago in Taiwan and spread east and west and actually colonized the entire Pacific Islands and the Indian Ocean partially until Madagascar. And this is not, it cannot only be based on the, on environmental pressures. It has to be related to culture, because making the decision of taking a boat and going actually nowhere, because you have no idea where you're going, you need to believe in something that will might take you somewhere else, but it's not based on I know where I'm going. So you cannot consider just the push-pull model. I mean, it's more than that. But that's archaeologically, of course, we have no access to that. Fortunately, we have access to Maori stories, so we know some myth include these kind of stories. So it encouraged people to take the boat and go for the trip. But that's for archaeologists is the most difficult part, because we don't have access to that. So let's explore now, and I still have a little bit of time, one by one the different types of migrations we can observe through the studies of human past. So first, migration of extinct members of the genus Homo. So Homo erectus and his descendant Neanderthal, 2.5 million years ago. So the first real colonization of Earth by humans were by Homo erectus, getting out of Africa 2.5 million years ago, more or less, colonizing first Asia and then Europe. In Europe, erectus will become what is now called Homo neanderthalensis. And in Asia, different groups of Homo erectus with different denominations as well. And they stayed in the area you see in blue. So there is absolutely no other humans or anything that looked like a human in the area in white in the rest of the Earth. It is only much later, so around 170,000 years ago, that what became Homo sapiens sapiens in Africa started spreading around the world and colonizing lands that were already occupied by other humans, or the species of humans. The interesting thing that we discovered recently, notably because of genetics, is we thought that Neanderthalensis in Europe were totally replaced by Homo sapiens sapiens, but it seems that we actually absorbed them a little bit. So it seems that 1% of our genetics are related to Homo Neanderthalensis, which means we reproduced with some of them. And that's quite a breakthrough. That's quite a very interesting discovery, because we thought we kill them all, or through diseases we actually make them disappear. But it seemed that some association were possible, which is surprising, because normally after 1,000 years of separation, sometimes we're not species separated, we're not anymore able to reproduce, but it seems that we did. So that's quite an interesting thing, and in terms of evolution, it's a fantastic way to pass a step quickly if you can absorb some characteristic of another species that is more adapted to the environment you're colonizing. This is a behavior that is extremely adaptive and works well, and it worked for Homo sapiens. And apparently, for example, red colors of the hair could be related actually to some remains of Neanderthalensis. Not that you're more Neanderthalensis than other if you're a redhead, but that means probably the expression of some recessive genes. Now, I like to dive a little bit in some cases of migrations, and mostly invasions of farmers, herders and boat builders, and to some extent hunter-gatherers, in many separate groups across most oceans and in all continents except Antarctica during the last 10,000 years. And I like to focus in particular in two cases, which I will develop. First of all, the migration of hunter-gatherers, and I'll show how it ended up in developing domestication of animals and plants. And the second one, the spread through Europe. So we'll see that in more detail. I wanted to talk to you about a little bit, like some kind of case of invasion involving coercition with the Viking, for example, but I think I'll pass that for now. An interesting thing, there is other type of migration, especially the more archaic one, let's say, not in a negative way. We have nomadic pastoralism, for example, which still exists nowadays. We have some form of nomadism based on fishing, hunting, and gathering that we know very well from the Paleolithic period before the domestication of plants and animals. So most humans were living on this kind of patterns, which mean a seasonal cyclical movement. So you move from point A in winter to a spring area, to a summer area, to a fall area, and you go around on a regular cycle. And you're just following resources, basically. So this is a well-known model, which almost disappeared from Earth nowadays. There is other variation. We call it semi-nomadic model with agriculture and domestication. Here is the example of Iroquoians in the San Lorenzo Valley, which actually build villages that will exist for 20 to 30 years until the lands around are too poor to be exploited. But those villages will have a lot of inhabitants during the spring and summer periods, but during the winter in general, people will spread in little groups and disappear into the environment just where the resources are. So you'll have a mix of nomadic and sedentary way of life. But now let's get to the two cases I wanted to develop today in more details. This type of migration is called definitive migration, without space limits, with or without new establishments. As you can see, as I said previously, it seems very determinist and very organized there is no much space for culture or decision of individuals, but that's unfortunately, that was provoked like having data only in archaeology. That's why it seems a bit very closed or very defined. And that's why we develop models. The case of the migration of hunter-gatherers which resulted in domesticating plants and animals is very interesting. And the first one that happened was in Mesopotamia. And we call this case the marginal zone hypothesis. That was a theory developed by Flannery. And it is based on the following. In the late Pleistocene, which is actually the Paleolithic period, so 12,000 years ago, at the end of the glaciation, when an area that was very stable in terms of resources, in terms of human inhabitants, suddenly became much more welcoming, let's say, or human-friendly. What we know about this type of environment, which are extremely stable, we know that we have closed population, we call it a closed population system, which means there is a self-regulation inside the groups that doesn't allow a growth of population. And there is many, many tricks to maintain a population in a stable way. We call it internal regulation means, and we have some cases that we know, for example, of children killing at birth. We have those cases in Amazonia, for example. So when you reach a too high population that you know you cannot maintain, sustain, you take the decision that you need to take for the group. And there's also cases that we know very well of isolation of elders. We know that, for example, in very rough environment in the north of Canada, for example. We know that as soon as an elder feels he's not able anymore to provide for the group and do anything for the group, and he's actually costing more in terms of consumption, in terms of resources, he will just disappear and die, of course, because he cannot participate into the life of the group. So we have many type of regulation that we know of. The one we don't know about is the cultural ones. So we don't know what kind of decision or what kind of ritual or habits were used to reduce maybe fertility or to avoid to have too many children in a group when you know you cannot support a certain amount. It is still observed in certain groups, human groups, especially in Amazonia nowadays, that we are able and we have been able in some part of human history to regulate ourselves. But with this deglaciation, or the end of glaciation period, we were suddenly in an environment with a constant growth of resources. So basically every year you have more resources than the year before. So of course you can sustain more population. So the population growth start rising every year as well, until you reach what we call the carrying capacity of the land. And this period was more or less like 1,000 or 2,000 years, at the Mesolithic period. And it resulted in overpassing again this carrying capacity of the land. And as a result, humans had to develop a new strategy, because self-regulation was not an option anymore. They gave up on that for probably a couple of thousand years. So the new system, it was what we call open population system, is migration. So that's the first, let's say, migration provoked by climate change, a major one. Of course, when you have to migrate, we don't know exactly how the decision were taken. But what we know is that we have daughter groups that get out from the main group and go away. And here is the example of the first neolithization, so the first migration that provoked the development of domestication of plants and animals. It's in Mesopotamia. In Mesopotamia, at the time, it didn't look like what is now Iraq. It was much more green, let's say, and much more rich in terms of resources. So as soon as you get out, you cannot go south because it's desert, and you have sea runs as well. The only option is east and north. And what we observe is in these areas, which is now today's Zagros Mountains in Iran and in the south of Anatolia, which probably looked like something like that 11,000 years ago, at this moment of expulsion, or those daughter groups are starting to move out from Mesopotamia. We have those extremely semi-arid areas, fertile valleys, but rough area compared to Mesopotamia. So those humans moving in those areas used to be hunter-gatherers and relying on the local resources. They had to find strategies to survive. And a quite surprising one, but that was successful, is to protect and select cereals and some animals. And what is fascinating, and we can observe it really, really easily in archaeology, is more or less in 200 years, you can see the cereals switching from this type of wild, really poor, let's say, in terms of productivity, cereals, to this type of production. And with this type of production, of course, you can sustain the life of a large group. For the goats, it's the same process. You can see a wild goat to the left, and it became what we know as goats nowadays, through selection. And so you reduce, of course, what is dangerous for you, and you select them according to your needs. So for milk production, from the wool, for the meat, of course, and you probably select like less aggressive behaviors, etc., etc. The problem is, and there are not few. You don't get only advantages from this massive switch. So we call it Neolithic Revolution because it's a massive change in the way human life was. For thousands of years, like we illustrated before, our lives were based on migration. And suddenly we were sedentary. We had a sedentary life, which is something absolutely unthinkable. I mean, completely, it's a major, major change. And that was based on domestication of cereals and animals. That allowed an increase of the carrying capacity, resulting in a demographic growth. And it allows us as well to settle. And it sustained the beginning of urbanization. The problem of this revolution, often actually in prehistory, we call it devolution, which means it's not necessarily a progress, it's not something for the best, because we had to renounce to the cyclical migration for what we are actually adapted. We had a drastic increase of work time per individual to support human groups. That's a major change, as hunter-gatherers, some ethnographer evaluates work in terms of activity to support the group about 6 hours per week, just to support the entire group. When we switch to Neolithic, so we switch to domestication, we're talking about your entire life dedicated to work. There is no more stop. Your life is work. So this is not necessarily for the best. We have massive nutritional deficiencies. We are not adapted to what we are eating, starting from the 12,000th century before now. We have massive intolerances, and we have to know that milk, we developed the enzyme to digest milk only 4,000 years ago in Northern Europe. But that means for 8,000 years, we were eating dairy products we were not able to digest. That means, I don't even want to imagine how difficult it was. I mean, it is, you have some nutrition out of it, but you're not prepared for that. Your system is not prepared for that. So it was probably difficult. Because of that as well, tooth decay is a well-known pathology we can observe on skeletons we find. New pathologies as well, carences, it's clearly, I mean, it's very easily observable on bones. And another consequence, and not the least, I think it's one of the most important, is it came with the apparition of the concept of property, which means property, material property, territorial property, and which will be the main source of inequalities and conflicts later on. And something that probably didn't exist in previous times, with many regulations and social regulations, and with, as we said before, extremely low demographics, conflicts was not an option because it was not necessary. And we don't have any archaeological demonstration of conflict before 6,000 years ago, let's say. People are under the pressure, the demographic pressure is not high enough to provoke these kind of behaviors. There is other ways. Conflict would just appear after the Neolithic period because of the demographic boom, let's say. Following this movement, and I'm gonna try to get a little bit faster, before this first, traumatic migration that provoked like the beginning of domestication of animals and plants, of course, we forgot how to auto-regulate, and I think we forgot since then, so that's now 12,000 years of forgetting that we need to auto-regulate ourselves. We never stopped reproducing, and that's, our curse for the last 10,000 years. We don't know how to regulate. And of course, what happened with those new technologies, we were able to sustain much more populations. And Anatolia, who became the core, let's say, for this Neolithic evolution, were overcrowded pretty fast. And of course, we had a sedentary way of life. So we lived in the villages, as you saw before. That's a good example of Châtelet-Houx. For 9,000 years before now, as you can see, it's quite dense. It's quite impressive. But of course, that cannot be sustained for too long. So people had to start moving again. Expelled from this too dense populated area. And there is two models for this exit of Anatolia. There is the model of wave of advanced produced by Ammerman and Cavalli-Sforza in 1994. And they qualify it as a non-event. That means it's a progressive movement of 1 kilometer per year, so probably 20 kilometers per generation of a slow process moving towards west. The other model is called leapfrogging, developed by Anthony. And Anthony assumed that we are more organized and it's more jump, from point A to point B, which means that involves like precursors, so adventure, people that go somewhere, explore, come back with the information, and then organize the group and then move in one shot. And I think now knowing more and more with our archaeological data what happened, it's probably a mix of both. And depending on when and where, we have a bit of waves and a bit of leapfrogging. So again, exit of Anatolia. So that's the point of, let's say, exit for those farmers, new farmers. And they moved, as we know, they moved with the entire farming package, as we call it. That means they moved with the plants, the animals, and the techniques. In the first case, with the move towards the Balkans, which one now is Bulgaria and Greece, we know that's for the north passage it's probably a wave, for the southern passage it's a jump. And in Thessaly, where actually I'm active in a Neolithic site, we know it's a jump. That means they arrived with the entire farming kit and installed themselves, because in Thessaly is very close actually to the condition, environmental condition of Anatolia. So you arrive somewhere, you already know. So it's easy to adjust. There's not much actually to adjust. You're already prepared for that. There is even a law we use in archaeology, the Zipf law, that means humans are just obeying the law of minimum effort. We always do the minimum to get the maximum result, but if we can avoid efforts, we avoid efforts, which is in general true. So this expansion, according to archaeologists, is possible with three different conditions. We need to adapt to the farming package. We saw, you know, in the case of the Balkans, no need to adjust it because it's already obviously adapted. You need an increase of birth rate and sedentarization. As we said before, the density of humans were about 0.1 human per square kilometer at the Paleolithic period, and we switch to 5 to 10 humans per square kilometer, which means we multiply by 5,200. It is difficult to imagine. You have absolutely no human visible, and suddenly you have humans everywhere, basically. The other important thing is increase of productivity. And normally we have an increase of productivity by 15 when you switch from hunter-gathering to farming. But with the work, with the extra work that comes with it, as we saw before. The second step, and that's probably a wave, it is a migration through the north of Europe first. We call it the corridor. I mean, it is one of the corridors, and probably through the Danube, because rivers are actually prehistoric highways. It's extremely easy and fast to use rivers when it's almost impossible to penetrate inland by land. So Danube was probably the first way of migrating west, and the second wave was probably south, following the coast and reaching Spain a little bit a bit later than north of Europe. But the first hypothesis in archaeology was that everything was migration. But basically we know now that those step 2 and 3 were migration, but they stopped probably in certain areas. And then we have a cultural diffusion, and that's the Zvelebi model, which means we have a period of contact between the farmers that settled down on the Danube Valley and in the Mediterranean coast, which creates what Zvelebi call availability phase, which means the local hunter-gatherers will get slowly interested by these new technologies and the new people that just moved in. And slowly, in the material we find in archaeology, we'll find what Zvelebi defined as 5% of the remain that correspond to the other group of the farmers. And then we have a second phase called substitution phase, where we start finding 5 to 50% of the material, archaeological material, is actually from the farming technologies, but still with the other 50% from the hunter-gatherer technologies. So we have a mixing, and it comes probably with the bilingualism and a mixing of languages. And the third step is consolidation phase, according to Zvelebi, and then we have an entire adoption and adaptation of the farming techniques, and probably an adoption also of the languages of farmers. And then we're talking about uniformization of languages all around Europe, and it appears that those languages are Indo-European. So basically, the hypothesis that we were talking before of the origin of north of the Black Sea, of Indo-European probably coming from the steppes, is probably wrong, and it's probably the archaeology one that is validated, the one produced by Renfrew in Anatolia, and the spread of the Indo-European probably correspond to this movement of farmers toward west. So languages and the farming kit moves probably west. And I'm going to stop right now. To conclude, archaeological data, comparative linguistics and genetics show that migration is one of the main characteristics of human behaviors since the last 2.5 million years. and to a certain extent it has remained the same. But we have a major problem. The planet is entirely colonized and we overpassed its global carrying capacity at the beginning of the 1980s. We might have heard about the Earth Overshoot Day, which is the date on which humanity's resource consumption for the year exceeds Earth's capacity to regenerate those resources that year. And this last year, in 2014, that date was August 19th, which means we are living 4 months in debt. And we are living in debt for 30 years. So from a prehistoric point of view, it leaves us with three options. First, we stop reproducing, or at least we have a significant and global demographic growth. Two, we reduce drastically consumption, and it comes probably combined with the previous solution. And that's the most radical thing, we continue as we do since the Neolithic Revolution, we continue to migrate and recolonize another planet because there is no other space to go anymore. And that's it.